The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement, which is entirely responsible for its content.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Now your host, Roger Waldron.
Today, my guest on Off the Shelf is Jack Midgley. Jack is a director with Deloitte Tohmatsu Consulting, located in Tokyo, Japan. Jack, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Roger. It's nice to be back with you. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
All right. Well, I'm looking forward to the discussion, and it's great timing. You're here in Washington, D.C. Got to get you on the show. We're going to talk about Deloitte's recently released Global Defense Outlook for 2015. But first, before we start talking on the report, in the contents of it and what you guys have observed with regard to trends in the defense outlook, sort of, can you just give us a background of, why Deloitte, what started this? What was the impetus for Deloitte doing these reports?
Well, we think that a broad perspective, particularly an economic and financial perspective on global defense issues, is a useful and maybe unusual way to analyze these questions. There's a lot of political and military technical analysis that's available on defense issues. But we like to take a more financial and economic point of view, and we think that when you do that, facts and patterns emerge that are often obscured by the political trends of the moment. Economic trends are harder to change. They move more slowly, and they often send a different signal. So, we've adopted that perspective, and it seems to be working well.
Right. It sounds like you really focus on the underlying fundamentals of what's going on versus the noise of the political. Is that fair description?
If you think about it, geography doesn't change much at all.
Right.
Economics changes very slowly. Politics changes from moment to moment.
Right.
And our clients are interested in the long-term, enduring trends that are really shaping the business and political environment. That's what we try to bring to light with these reports.
Right, great. So, and we're going to get into the report now and talk about some of those long-term trends and what you're seeing. First, just before we get down in the details, can you give a general outline or overview of the findings of the report and some of the key takeaways?
Well, this year we focused on a couple of facts. One is that the global economy is becoming less militarized. That shocks some people when they hear that for the first time. But we think that over the long term and on a broad array of indicators, the global economy is actually becoming much less dependent on military spending. And that raises some really important questions for defense ministries and for companies that do defense work. So that's one trend. Another is the broad decline in global violence. This is a trend that's continued for decades, but it's not always obvious when you read the daily news.
Right, absolutely. Yep.
And, we think that also that decline has produced political impacts that are important for our clients. We took a look this year for the first time at cyber vulnerability. And I think there—
Very timely, Jack.
It was very— Yeah, it was very timely. And we'd been frustrated by the lack of good public data on cyber. So instead of trying to count cyber attacks, which is just not really feasible, we decided to turn the tables and look at vulnerability, and I think we found some interesting and important trends there.
Yeah, very, very good. Well, let's sort of start by tackling the budget issue first. The reduced militarization or the reduced spending on overall as part of the overall economy and budgets of defense spending. And I know you looked at it and tried and basically divided up the top 50. Is that right? Spenders. Can you generally describe the categories that you guys identified in your
report?
And what does it mean?
Right. Our study looks at the 50 countries whose defense spending totals over 95% of global defense budgets. So that's 50 countries. But 50 is too many to think about. So we segment that group into four groups. by looking at their GDP, their gross domestic product, how rich is the country. And we use $20,000 per capita GDP as the dividing line. Countries that make have a per capita GDP above $20,000 are generally considered wealthy, and those below the $20,000 line less so. So that was one cut. But then we also looked at how intensely each country has committed to defense, and there we used 2% of GDP on defense spending as the dividing line. That number is important because, among other reasons, it's the published budget target for members of NATO. But it's also a useful way to divide what we call the spenders from the economizers. So we group the top 50 countries into high and low income and spenders and economizers. And when we do that, I think we see some interesting patterns in the changes over time in defense spending and also in the defense policies of those countries.
So one of the, I have a specific question with regard to, one of the higher income economizers. And Japan is identified as one of those countries. And I just found that kind of fascinating given all that's going on in Asia Pacific environment, and China's turning coral reefs into runways and that sort of thing. Is that something that's likely to change, and why are they economizers? Why is that decision? Is it still they're constrained by their constitution? Can you address that a bit?
It does surprise people, given the tough neighborhood that they work in, that Japan only spends 1% of its GDP on defense. But that's a long-standing policy constraint that's unlikely to change. Japan's constitution, in particular Article 9 of the Japanese constitution, abolished the armed forces and allows Japan only to maintain self-defense forces. And by long tradition, Japan has spent only 1% of GDP on defense. That's becoming problematic as growth slows, because effectively that limits the growth of Japan's defense budget. Today, Japan spends about $54 billion annually on defense. China spends three times that, and that that gap is going to continue to grow. So that's why, technically, Japan is a high-income economizer, because GDP is very high, but it spends only 1% on defense.
Right. And GDP is not growing rapidly.
GDP is not growing.
So fundamentally, for the low-income spenders like Japan, it's a function of the growth of the percentages that are devoted to the military are relatively stable, but the growth of the budget and the economy is what sort of reflects the raw numbers get bigger. Is that fair?
That is about right. China, I think, is a country that comes most readily to mind. China's defense budget is growing. There's a lot more money to spend on defense in China. But that's because the Chinese economy is growing. If you look at China, there are more cars, there's more air pollution, there are more babies, and there's also more money spent on defense. However, when you step back from the overall number and ask what is really driving this, what you see is that China is actually growing defense spending at a slower rate than its economy is growing. So China can keep up this level of defense spending growth
for a long, long
basically
time.
Basically, forever.
Right, yeah.
That raises a different kind of policy challenge. If China's defense budget was just a policy choice, it was just a political commitment to spend a lot of money on defense, then you could expect to whittle away that political consensus over time. But that's not what's happening. This is a structural change in the world economy. China's growth and China's technological advancement puts it in a position where it can spend a significant amount of money on defense while still growing defense spending slower than GDP, which allows it to invest elsewhere.
Right, greater flexibility.
Buy roads, to buy infrastructure, to make other foreign investments. So we have in China an evolving strategic partner that is committed to achieving first world leading edge technology and has the financial and economic wherewithal to reach parity over time with the United States. That's the long-term strategic problem, not whether or not there's a 10,000-foot airway in the Spratly Islands.
Right, right. And parity is inevitable?
Well, it is inevitable. If you think about where the Chinese army was, where the PLA was, say, in 1960, this was an army that had nuclear weapons, but whose basic military capability wasn't very different from what it was in the 1930s. Today, the grandchildren of those soldiers of the PLA in the 50s have bequeathed a military establishment that has not just ICBMs, but a military space program, an aircraft carrier, the J-31 stealth fighter, unmanned aerial vehicles that are close to U.S. standard, and a brand new tank. But we shouldn't expect China to have anything else. We
right.
shouldn't expect it to limit itself.
Right,
to,
sit on its hands.
No.
Right,
why, yeah. No.
Yeah, and Jack, right now we have to take our first break. My guest today is Jack Midgley. He's a director with Deloitte Tohmatsu Consulting in Tokyo, Japan. We're talking about Deloitte's recently released Global Defense Outlook for 2015. And when we come back, we'll continue our discussion of the current defense environment overall, and then we'll start transitioning a little bit to cyber risk. You are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
Agencies today understand they are under a constant cyber threat. They also understand that in order to build continuous diagnostics and mitigation solutions that meet their mission requirements, they need a partner, not just a vendor. At Booz Allen Hamilton, we approach CDM by rolling up our sleeves and partnering with our clients to develop long-term solutions based on our cybersecurity experience and tradecraft. Our cyber experts and technologists work with agencies to tailor blueprints that meet their needs so that they can turn insight into action and stay in command and control of their IT enterprise. We build solutions that dynamically defend our clients' most critical assets, keeping them ahead of threats. Today, data and technology are critical to meet the business needs at any agency. And at Booz Allen Hamilton, we're here to help our clients be truly cyber ready. Learn more about our CDM services and solutions at boozallen.com/CDM.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Jack Midgley. Jack is a director with Deloitte Tohmatsu Consulting in Tokyo, Japan. Here in D.C., and we're talking about Deloitte's recently released Global Defense Outlook for 2015. And when we took the break, we're talking about the current sort of overall defense environment and levels of spending, percentage of GDP, all those sort of things, and what that dynamic is. And what we're hearing is this comparability in terms of capability over the long term, especially when we specifically talked about China, Jack. So I guess, the next question is how, in my mind, I guess in everyone's mind, who hopefully is listening, is how does the United States respond to that? What are the United States options, maneuvers? And there's talk of, a third offset, which if you could explain what that terminology means first and then talk about, a third offset as part of U.S. strategy, whether it makes sense or not, or your views on that would be great.
Well, the third offset refers to a drive to invest more in research and development and advanced capabilities to counter what's perceived as a Chinese threat. The first offset was, of course, was nuclear weapons. The second was precision guidance. And the third now, we don't know what the third one is likely to be, but Secretary Carter and his predecessor both expressed DOD's view that because the Chinese have increased their defense budget, we need to dramatically increase U.S. spending on R&D.
Right, and we're seeing that in some of the, there's a better buying power 3.0 and a lot of discussion about R&D and access to commercial innovation, however they can get to that, which isn't clear.
There is a lot of arm waving about access to Silicon Valley and so forth, and it sounds a bit like a search for some sort of a magic bullet. When you look at the numbers, though, I think a different story emerges. In 2018, if budgets just stay on track, The United States will budget about $63 billion for research and development, military research and development. That will be nearly 60% of the entire global defense R&D budget.
Wow.
It's very difficult to see a shortage of inputs as our problem.
Maybe it's the outputs.
well, that's the point. The question isn't how much we're spending on R&D. The question is to what end and on what kinds of programs. What's really happening in Asia and the other developing countries is that they're putting very heavy upward pressure on defense innovation. So if you look across all the defense budgets in Asia, the lower income countries, their defense R&D is the fastest growing of all their budget categories. It's growing faster than procurement. It's growing way faster than operations budgets. And it'll rise by almost 30% over the next 5 years. So they're investing heavily. China has said for years, part of its published defense policy is that it intends to reach the global technology frontier by 2020. And they have now the financial
wherewithal
and economic wherewithal, and I think the engineering wherewithal to begin to do it. Three quarters of the total increase in defense R&D between now and 2018 will come from China, India, and Russia. And that will happen while the R&D budgets of the developed countries stay pretty flat. So you can see that within the broad increase in defense budget, those three countries, China, India, and Russia, are making an explicit commitment to improve defense technology. But when you peel that back, there's an economic reason to do it. Defense R&D helps build domestic defense industry. Domestic defense industry allows you to export.
Right. Jobs,
and so sales. A lot of what this is about is continuing to grow a domestic defense industry. That's why we're seeing this kind of R&D. To come back to your original question, the large U.S. defense budgets, the growing defense R&D budgets in Asia Pacific leave a person to wonder whether we can really engage in a spending race to find some sort of a magic bullet. Maybe the right policy is to take a harder look at what we're spending current R&D dollars on and to keep in mind that, for example, ballistic missile defense still dominates most of the U.S. R&D budget.
Really?
And I think one can legitimately ask whether that is the best use of those resources.
Is that money well spent at a certain point, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Right, and what's the return on that investment today?
I think it's a very open question given the world that we appear to be living in now.
Right. Well, some folks too also suggest maybe cutting back on the production of the F-35 and shifting money from that somehow to new systems or development of new systems. Does that make sense to you?
Well, F-35 is an expensive program, and our partners around the world, including the Japanese, are asking questions about the cost-benefit proposition associated with F-35. The program is deeply entrenched, and it's going to continue in some form. But you're getting to the right question. Is the most advanced technology always the best answer, or do we need to operate a little farther away from the cutting edge where we can get a higher return on defense investment? Clearly, if you look at what the Chinese have done to innovate, a lot of their innovation has just been to copy or to borrow.
Mm-hmm.
I think the most visible example of that is the aircraft carrier, the Liaoning, which the Chinese bought from the Russians for a few $100,000 and towed it back to China. And now they're using that vessel to learn about naval aviation.
Right.
That didn't cost very much, but the change in capability that it has created is enormous. So they made a smart move there by moving themselves down the innovation curve without spending a lot of money.
Right.
We should be thinking about similar kinds of initiatives, and I hope our Pentagon leadership is doing so.
So just real quickly, when we talk about the sort of flattening of defense spending as a percentage of the budgets and at least in the in the Western countries. What does that mean for the companies? Are we, when you mentioned, China, India, and Russia creating, organic, defense industrial basis for their export and, that sort of thing. What does it mean for companies here? Are we talking potentially more consolidation in the marketplace? More partnering with firms overseas? Is that anything that you, have a thought about?
It doesn't require a lot of imagination to see that what's going to happen in the defense industry in the next 10 years looks a lot like what happened to the automobile industry in the 1980s. This used to be an American game, and then it became an American and European game, and now it's going to become a global game. The Russians, the Chinese, the Indians have publicly committed, and the Japanese now, have publicly committed to growing defense exports. The reason they're doing that is twofold. One is to grow their domestic defense industry and improve its capabilities. And the other is to, frankly, to lower the costs, lower the unit costs, so that they can afford to buy their own equipment.
Right.
If you look,
that's like the F-35 example.
F-35. Yeah. The Japanese have a similar case in the P-1 maritime patrol aircraft, which is hugely expensive, very capable, very expensive, so expensive that it's hard for the self-defense forces to buy it. So they want to export it. But just because you need to doesn't mean that it's possible.
Right.
And as we look out at the actual market over the next few years, it's very hard to square this entry by China, India, Russia, and Japan into the defense export market with flat demand.
Right, excess. You're gonna have excess capacity.
I think we're looking at a lot of excess supply over the couple years. Mm-hmm. Over the next couple of years, there are 10 countries. 10 top exporters that account for almost 60% of the defense procurement growth through the next 5 years. So most of the growth is concentrated in a few countries. So that's where the market is. Well, that market, those 10 countries have all said that they want to continue growing exports. Who are they going to export to?
Right, right.
They can't export to each other. The Russians say they want to grow exports, for example. But their big customers are China and India. China and India have both said they intend to substitute for imports.
Right.
So not everyone in the world can keep growing their defense exports. So we think there's likely to be a crunch.
Right. Okay. And on that note, Jack, we have to take our next break. When we come back, we'll be talking more to Jack Midgley. He's the director with Deloitte Tohmatsu Consulting in Tokyo, Japan. And when we come back, we'll start talking a little bit about cyber risk and this is some fascinating analysis newly done in this year's Deloitte Global Defense Outlook. And you are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
The mission of government involves critical efforts to improve national defense, economic security, health services, and citizens' lives. The strategy and technology consultants of Booz Allen Hamilton are proud to help government address cyber threats, reform the financial system, modernize infrastructure, and protect our nation. For nearly 100 years, Booz Allen has partnered with clients to deliver results that endure. To see Booz Allen's ideas in action, visit BoozAllen.com.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today my guest is Jack Midgley. He is director with Deloitte Tohmatsu Consulting in Tokyo, Japan. And we are talking about Deloitte's recently released Global Defense Outlook for 2015. And this segment, we're going to start talking about something that's really in the headlines right now, and that's cyber risk. And there's some fascinating stuff in this report that I hadn't really thought about, but I think it's really important when people think about cybersecurity, how the United States can or can't respond, and what difference response will make in certain instances. But first, let's start. And the Deloitte introduces a cyber risk index. Can you talk about what that is and what it does?
Sure. We wanted to understand how countries' vulnerability to cyber attack is changing over time. And of course, whenever you look at cyber, it's hard to find good public data. We tried to count cyber attacks, and there's just no good way to do it. Some companies report individual phishing emails as cyber attacks. So it's a very difficult play. Instead of doing that, we turned the tables and asked, where are the targets for cyber attacks? The notion being that if we could count the number of targets, we could assess a country's relative level of vulnerability. To count targets, we used public data, data published by the IMF, that actually does this count on secure internet servers, number of internet users, mobile subscribers, and so forth. And we built an index that allows us to compare the top 50 countries over time. What we're measuring with this index is the intensity of the economy's reliance on the internet. And our notion is that that level of intensity, as that level of intensity increases, countries become more vulnerable. It's not a complete measure. For example, we don't count the SCADA systems that operate power plants and so forth. We just haven't been able to get a good count of that. But if we're right with our index, what we see is that there's a very sharp difference in vulnerability between the high-income countries and the low-income countries like China, Russia, and India, and that that difference in vulnerability has increased dramatically over the last few years. For example, the highest dependence, the highest economic dependence on the internet is in the very rich countries, South Korea, Netherlands, Switzerland, Denmark, and the United States, of course. Those countries are, by our count, a full order of magnitude more vulnerable to cyber attack than China and Russia. And that gap is widening as the rich countries continue to develop. What that suggests to us is two things. First, the lower income countries are clearly incented to behave aggressively in cyberspace because the rich countries...
And we're seeing that, right?
We're seeing it. Yeah, yeah. The rich countries are much more vulnerable. So there's more to attack. The second fact that emerges is that a policy of proportionate response probably doesn't make any sense in cyber. The reason is that, for example, if the United States says we're going to respond in kind to a cyber attack by some country, the fact is that there aren't enough targets to hit with cyber. And the economies are differently exposed to the internet. So the recent U.S. policy announcement of proportionate cyber response, measured proportionate response in cyberspace, does not square with the data that that we have. If we're right about this huge gap in vulnerability, then we should be committed to a policy of disproportionate response in ways outside cyberspace that are not predictable and can't be planned against. If, for example, the Chinese know that we will only respond to cyber attacks in cyberspace, they present far fewer targets than the United States, and so they have a strategic advantage. That's not sound policy, and we ought to be thinking about that.
So what are other ways outside cyber that, you know, the policymakers should consider, or do you think?
Well, what comes to mind immediately are trade measures, other types of sanctions.
So you're talking more, even more, a political, economic,
political
dynamic.
And economic, and there are certainly a broad range of military tools available that our military colleagues know more about than I do. But committing to a kind of tit for tat on cyber just fundamentally misreads the different vulnerability that the Chinese, the Russians, and others have to cyber strikes. Their economies are not dependent on the internet the way we are.
Right. The question, though, is, you know, it does make sense to the extent, and I guess would you consider this disproportionate, like, depending on, you know, what is struck in the United States? If the United States focuses on some key defense, you know, network in China, let's say, is that...
Well, that's the problem.
Right.
Is that, the Chinese don't appear to present that kind of a target.
Okay.
So
okay.
If a military target is struck in the United States, our policy might be, a policy consistent with these facts would be to respond with trade measures that don't directly strike the Chinese military. That complicates the planning problem. And it minimizes the incentive to attack.
Right. So in your view, one of the things I wanted to ask about, because you know we have the OPM attack just recently and all those records that have been compromised. And I think you probably touched on it in previous segments a little bit, but how much does cyber contribute to this reduction in capability gaps between, you know, when you're talking about China, United States, you know, overall defense capability gaps, even just economic espionage?
Well, China's policy and China's budgets committed to advancing its cyber capabilities. That's covered by the broad commitment to reach the technology frontier, and it's covered by what they're doing in R&D and budgets. So they intend to match the developed world in terms of cyber capability. That's coming. It may be here now.
Right. I'm also thinking about the appropriation of intellectual property, you know, through cyber. How has it changed, you know, the playing field, you know, whether it's the J31 and just, you know, you read, I've read articles about it, and it looks just like F-35 or, you know, F-22. How much is that? I mean, the United States is a target-rich environment with a lot of technology. Is that fundamentally contributing to a more rapid reduction in the capability gaps?
I think the facts show that that's true. Whatever technical advantage China or any other country can obtain by taking intellectual property from the West, we should expect them to act in a way that is consistent with their national interests. If we can't defend it, then we can't be surprised when it shows up somewhere else.
Right.
That's not necessarily bad behavior. That's behavior in the national interest taken by a country or countries that are becoming increasingly capable. This we're not dealing with China of 1990.
Right.
We're dealing with a modern, sophisticated, not necessarily hostile nation that intends to enjoy the same standard of living that rich countries in the rest of the world enjoy.
Yeah. Jack, we have to take our last break. When we come back, we'll be talking more to Jack Midgley. He's director with Deloitte Tohmatsu Consulting in Tokyo, Japan. And, you know, we're going to focus a little bit more on Asia Pacific defense and talk about, you know, the relationships across that region and, you know, what does it mean, whether there's overarching institutions versus bilateral arrangements in terms of the, you know, development of overall defense policy. You are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
In the ever-changing national security and IT environments, L3 delivers innovative, cost-effective solutions. As a Fortune 200 company, L3 offers customers global end-to-end services and solutions for large-scale systems. No matter the challenge, L3 has the agility, technology, and innovation required for mission performance. From cybersecurity to next-generation IT, L3's passion for its customers' missions drives its commitment to excellence. L3. Agility, innovation, performance.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Jack Midgley. Jack is a director with Deloitte Tohmatsu Consulting in Tokyo, Japan. In this segment, we're going to talk a little bit about the, more specifically, about the Asia-Pacific defense environment. And, you know, I'm just going to open it up to you, Jack. You know, this is an area that you focused on. You've done other individual reports. We actually talked a little bit about it on the last show. But I think it's worth talking about again, because it seems to me, as you note, as the report notes, that's where the growth in spending is, that's where a lot of the action is, and countries making commitments to, you know, closing technological gaps and that sort of thing. So first, you know, just the current sort of state of play with regard to sort of the international defense relationships in Asia and what it means.
It's the biggest. I think this is the biggest set of changes that the defense communities face since the end of the Second World War. The changes that are happening in Asia Pacific now are profound, they're far reaching, and they're irreversible. Over the next 5 years, the global defense budget will only increase by 6% globally. But while that happens, defense budgets in Asia will grow by almost 20% to about $612 billion by 2018. That's equal to what the United States spends.
But, yeah.
So
it's like throwing another United States down in the middle of...
Well, in more ways than one, right. Because at the same time, you know, while that absolute number is going up, the Asian countries will also spend more than half of the non-U.S. defense procurement in the world, two-thirds of non-U.S. Defense research and development. That's an enormous change in input, and it's being manifest in tremendous new capabilities, particularly in China, Russia, and India. The challenge is that while that material advance is taking place, politically and institutionally, the Asian security community is not making much progress. We're accustomed in the U.S. to thinking about the great alliances, NATO. If you look back far enough, the Warsaw Pact.
Mm-hmm. I remember
not that.
Not that
far. Right. And others. Where,
not for you and I.
where there are substantial kind of multilateral forums in which countries can talk about defense issues. That approach is absent in Asia, in part because of the different economic levels of the players, in part because of national ties and national hostility. But there's a real gap emerging between the advanced, high-speed, very sophisticated military technical capabilities in Asia and the limited ability of security management institutions to deal with crisis and prevent conflict.
Does that sort of, you know, the lack of a broad-based sort of security institutions, you know, and you mentioned some of the reasons. How much does the history of World War II play in that, just from a sort of cultural perspective when you think about, you know, just generally think about, you know, Japan and what happened, and does that play into it at all or not?
Well, of course
it does. You know.
Yeah, of course it does. I think it goes back farther than World War II. The non-aligned status of India, yeah. the really rapid change in China's capability, the profound changes that have happened as we went from the former Soviet Union to Russia, those political changes and leadership changes combine with the historical alignments in the region. And as a result, what happens is these countries talk to each other bilaterally. They don't. There's just never been a pan-Asian security solution that has worked. So we're dealing with a part of the world that is increasingly wealthy and very capable, but where there sometimes isn't anybody to talk to about regional security issues. And I'm not just military, but humanitarian assistance and disaster relief, crisis response. Confidence-building measures. These all are being done bilaterally, and that may not necessarily work terribly well. I don't want to overdraw the analogy, but Europe in the 1910s relied heavily on bilateral,
mm-hmm.
And that didn't turn out so well. So one wonders if there might be an opportunity for the United States, China, Russia, India to find a way to build some multilateral security architectures in Asia Pacific. That hasn't happened so far. And it may be the case that the Chinese simply don't want to do that. One could infer that it's in China's interest to simply continue to grow and create preponderance in Asia Pacific, to make itself the de facto kind of center of, mm-hmm. of security. And they certainly have the size and capability to do that.
Right. So, you know, we've got about 2 minutes left. I wanted to shift gears sort of rapidly. And one of the interesting things in the report as well is a discussion with regard to, personnel costs and the challenges those face, particularly, obviously we're familiar here in the United States with personnel costs associated with the military and those costs continuing to grow, and our defense leaders talking about that, and something needs to be done to to address that as a budget balancing sort of approach so we can make sure we can still invest in technologies as well as people. You have any thoughts on that?
Well, military personnel budgets are out of control, certainly in Asia, in the lower income countries generally, they've gone up by a third in the last 5 years. Costs per active duty service member have gone up by a third in 5 years. Well, you can't keep doing that. Even the Chinese have begun to complain that they can't keep soldiers, they can't keep talent. Because Chinese companies are willing to pay for the kind of technical talent that the Chinese military needs. So they're resorting to incentive payments, recruiting bonuses, the kind of measures that we would see much more often in the West. The Russians have the same problem. So they're doing a lot around military housing, which has been neglected since the Soviet period. They're working on military housing. They're working on pay and allowances so that they can keep the kind of people that they need to operate these increasingly sophisticated systems. Everyone now is confronting a problem with rising personnel costs.
Right. Does anyone figured out the solution to that? The formula? It makes sense.
It doesn't look that way.
It doesn't
look that way. And I think as the global economic recovery continues.
More challenging.
It becomes more challenging. Yeah.
Right. Yep. Jack, I want to thank you for being on the show today. My guest today has been Jack Midgley. He's director with Deloitte Komatsu Consulting in Tokyo, Japan. And we've been talking about Deloitte's recently released Global Defense Outlook for 2015. And you're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.